Hello, I'm Angela Walsh. Welcome to the Downhill Slide. This podcast is chats with people who have passed that midway point of life, we're saying the age of 50, and how things have changed over the years. Dramas in life, happy memories in life, we're revisiting all of those, and maybe how they've impacted us and changed our perspective as we get older. One of the earlier chats I had when I was first deciding to do this podcast was with a guy I work with in radio. We have a fabulous time on the air, lots of laughs. But when we talked in my studio, he ended up revealing something I did not expect. Everybody in life has dark times. We all deal with that differently. God willing, we get through it. And he certainly had a dark time in his life. Anyway, here's my chat with Graham Day. We work together.
We do indeed.
At the moment, in case we lose our jobs, everyone's losing their jobs.
Well, then we will be on a downhill slide.
But that's the funny thing, don't you reckon? When you get into your 50s, I guess when I was a kid, I thought when you get into your 50s, that's it. You're kind of set for life. But it's not the case anymore, is it?
Well, at school, they never spoke about retirement, really. All I knew was you could do it at 55 or 65. And that ain't going to happen for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I don't know how people retired at 55, but the world was different back then and what have you. I just don't think that we were instructed enough at school to look at the pitfalls of actually getting over the age of 50.
When I was at school, I think they used to steer you towards the bank exam or the post office exam, something like that, and that was supposed to be a job that set you up for life. But it's so many people are now out of work even in those jobs.
Well, I remember in commerce at high school, they basically taught you how to fill out a check, and I failed that. I couldn't even do that.
Did you like school?
I was very social at school. Literally social at school. I had a way of basically twisting the teacher's arm in regard to when we had English periods and also maths periods. If there was social coming up, we used to do all the music for it. I used to get out of those classes by basically making light boxes for discos and things.
How old were you? What age?
Oh, we're talking about probably fifth form, sixth form.
What does that mean?
Well, 15, 16, 17, round about that.
All right. I'm originally from Queensland, Graham. It's different up
yes,
there.
Yes, it is.
So were you in a band at that age?
You mean? No. A group of us, we used to have school dances, and a group of us said, look, why don't we go out and buy our own gear? And it was right in the middle of the disco era, and we basically got a disco committee together, went out and through school funds, bought our own gear. And we did the dances at school. And basically you'd have to pay to go in to pay for the gear. But then other high schools around the south coast where we were heard that we were doing these discos and hired us to do them. And we had to stop going to Kiama High School and Nowra High School and other high schools doing the discos because we were making so much they couldn't explain it away to the tax department, which is great. Great.
That's not a bad setup. You're talking about turntable days, aren't you? Records, turntables, and so being a radio broadcaster, was that your entry? Did that inspire you? I guess to be on the radio?
Not really. We were just kids that were into music, and we went to a place called, and I don't know if it still exists, but we went to a place called Sound on Stage in Sydney to buy the gear, and they had everything you could ever imagine, from mirror balls to rope lights to fluorescent lights, black lights and things like that, and we were just in another world. It was just sensational, and we bought the gear, brought it back and used it. And funny enough, when I left school, which was 2 weeks before the HSC, I didn't lean towards that at all. I leant towards being a storeman and packer. Because my father said, look, I've got a job for you, because he was the manager. $150 a week, do you want it? Or do you want to do your HSC? I said, give me the dollar.
Why? Why did you make that choice?
Because I didn't have any aspirations of going to university or anything like that. And I really didn't have a path worked out, to be honest with you. I didn't really have a path at all. And so I became a storeman packer. And you know what it's like when you're young. I was 17. and or 18, and cash in your pocket allows you to go out and have a great old time.
Do you regret that decision?
No, not at all. Not at all. The journey and learning yourself, I believe, can be a little bit better. Probably can't do it these days, but a little bit better than the university path.
Well, you've got kids, Graham. Are you happy with their decisions, knowing what you know about life?
Oh, well, they went through and did their HSCs. They didn't go to uni, but they made a fist of it, and they're comfortable, and they all make mistakes like we all do, but it worked out pretty well. Like, I don't have any qualifications to do anything, really.
That's why you're a radio announcer, is that it?
Well, no, it wasn't to get into radio. I actually wanted to, funny enough, at a young age, as well as doing the music thing, we also set up a production company with a Super 8 movie camera. And I remember nagging Mum and Dad to buy this $150 Super 8 movie camera and projector secondhand. Back in those days, you looked at the classifieds in the paper. And we bought it, and a mate and I set up this company called Bludgerigar Productions, and we just did mad films. And from that, I actually went to Wollongong University and said to them, Mum took me because I didn't have my licence, and I said, I want to get into TV and be a cameraman. What do you suggest? And back in those days, they didn't have any courses, and the girls on the front desk kind of looked at each other and said, oh, the best way you can get into TV is start in radio. And that was their that was their career advice, to be honest with you.
So you've been doing radio for a while. Did you ever dabble in TV then?
No. It was just circumstances that got me into radio. Working at the place I worked at, we used to supply corner stores and what have you with grocery items and what have you. We were wholesalers. And my father, as I said, who was the manager of this place called Davis and Penny, he knew the Lifesaver rep really, really well. And the Lifesaver rep knew the local sports guy, a guy called Bernie Regan, who did sport at the local radio station. And Dad told him I was interested in getting into radio and hence then to TV. And he spoke to Bernie and he said, look, why don't you send him up one Friday night when I'm doing the sports show and he can help me out. And I went up one Friday night shaking like a leaf because I didn't know what the media world was like or the radio world was like. And I sat down. He said, the first thing you can do is go and make me a cup of coffee. And I made about four cups of coffee before I thought it was right. Took them into him. He handed me a piece of paper, and I said, what's that for? And he said, in about 30 seconds' time, you're going to give us your tips on the greyhounds that are racing at Nowra tonight. And that was the start of it. Been there ever since.
So it sounds like you were keen, and just making the coffee, you believe something like that, doing those little things for people will get you further than just walking in like a cocky so-and-so? Which you kind of are now.
look, to be honest, I think it was, I went, my mother and father didn't exactly get on that well. And I was the eldest. My brother was 3 years younger. And I remember them having pretty into it Barneys, which they would admit. And my brother used to come into my room when he was very, very young crying because he heard Mum and Dad fighting. And I used to take him into my bed and calm him down and get him off to sleep and what have you. And I think I was about seven, so he was around about four. And I think from there, my personality kind of turned into a saver, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like I always looked for the person that was, even with friends and what have you, the guy or the girl that didn't have friends would become my friends, or the ones that were a little bit quirky and people shied away from them. I tended to befriend them. And I think basically just flapping my gums was an expression of, because I was very shy, very, very shy. I think expressing myself through chatting or talking was a way of cleansing what was going on at home, if you know what I mean. I was so shy I couldn't even, I would give somebody 10 cents to buy me 5 cents worth of lollies at the general store when we got off the bus, because I didn't have the gumption to talk to the to the shop owner.
Wow. So do you feel, has radio changed you, do you think, into a more outgoing person? Because you are reasonably outgoing these days.
I don't think it was radio. I always remember we were coming back, we went on a typical primary school excursion to Taronga Zoo, And on the way back, I just said to the – and it was a boring trip and, you know, you can only see the wheels on the bus go around and around so many times. And I said to the teacher, look, I'll tell a few stories. And they kind of looked at me and said, okay, then. And they kind of clapped their hands and said, Graham's going to tell some stories. And it just came to me and I just kept telling stories. And it wasn't – they weren't the greatest stories in the world because I think I was in about fifth grade. But you could hear a pin drop on the bus. Kids would listen to it and laugh and what have you. And I remember getting a little merit certificate at the assembly 2 weeks later awarded to me for telling stories on the bus on excursion. And that little thing gave me confidence and then went from there, really.
So do you think maybe a performance might have been a path for you if you had those opportunities to be maybe on the stage?
Not so much on the stage. What I used to do, because I couldn't play a musical instrument, when I used to do discos, and I used to do discos at pubs and clubs from the age of 14, I used to put on a show. Like, it wasn't just rolling and spinning the discs. Like, I'd talk to the people and laugh with the people and what have you. And that used to go off a treat, and they used to love that with the music. So I suppose that was almost performing.
You really were a performer, but when you thought about what career you wanted, do you wanted to be a cameraman?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that if I hadn't have thought about getting into one side, I wouldn't have got into the other side. Like I said, I loved making those silly little movies. I used to sit down when I was a young kid with my mother and watch the Academy Awards. And as you know, the Academy Awards used to come in at night. And I used to sit there watching them going up and getting their awards. And I used to think, I'm going to do that one day. I'm going to get up there and I'm going to do that one day. Not emceeing it or anything, but just doing it. And I believe, and it's funny, the downhill slide, I believe now is probably at the age of 58, the best time to grab onto something and do it. Because I think I've discussed with you, if you've got that philosophy of you only want to do it once, you know what I mean? Like if you could go out and do a documentary that was an award winner, or you could go out and do something, write a book or do something like this that was an award winner that a lot of people listen to, you've only got to do it once and then you've ticked that box. And I suppose with what I've done, as I said earlier, being a saver and helping the community and putting yourself out there and doing stuff to raise money on the air and what have you, that is the performance, you know what I mean?
Well, you've certainly done that in your radio career. You've done a few great things for the communities that you've worked in and for. And just explain about that time when you did raise a lot of money in a very short time.
It's just a matter of, as I said, if you see a situation, I tend to jump in and try and help the situation. I'll never forget a mate of mine from the Southern Highlands who I hadn't seen for probably 2 or 3 or 4 years. He was coming out of a side street and I was going into the same street and he went down the window and he yelled out, "Hey, Graham, still trying to save the world?" And it's not about saving the world. It's just about if you're in a position where somebody asks you to do something and you can do it, whether that be raise money or make people aware of something that isn't the way it should be, that's all part of it as far as I'm concerned.
But let's talk about what you did. Come on.
Well, right from the start, I'll tell you a quick story right from the start that kind of set me on the path that if I could do something for the community just by being involved and saying yes, that was kind of like my destiny. And the first thing was we got a call at the radio station back in the 1980s, and Camp Quality had never held a camp on the south coast of New South Wales ever, and they wanted to do that. And they rang up and they said, "Look, we've got kids, these little kids with cancer, and we don't have the money to run this camp. Would you be interested in helping us out?" And I said, "Yeah, no problem." And to cut to the chase, effectively what happened was we decided that we were going to raise this money for these kids, and they needed a certain amount of money. And I suggested, why don't we have a radio marathon where somebody goes on the air and raises money over a period of time? And what happened was they said, okay, that's a great idea, Graham, you can do it. And I jumped on the air and I think it was 16 hours or 20 hours nonstop being on the air. And people donated money and what have you. And we raised enough money so those kids could have their first camp on the South Coast. But the thing that really got to me was these young kids came back to the radio station to say thanks, and one of them, who was kind of their leader, was this little kid, and he'd had cancer since he was two, and his age was probably about 11 or 12, but he was the size of a six-year-old because his body had been riddled with cancer for that amount of time. And anyway, they sang this song, which was a thank you song, and everyone from the radio station was crowded out the front. But as they sang, the emotion of it meant that people started to walk away because they couldn't contain their emotions and they didn't want to show the kids. And there was myself and the manager that waited to the end of the song. And this young fella came up. I'll never forget his name. His name was Stephen. This young fella came up and he looked up at him and he said, "You're going to cry, aren't you, mate?" And I looked down at this kid who had, like, the knowledge of an old man. I said, "No." And he goes, "Yes, you are. They always do." And it was just one of those moments where you thought, well, if you can do this and if you can use what you do to help people like that, then you're on the right course. And probably about 2-3 weeks later, the organisers of Camp Quality rang and said that he'd passed away. And that was kind of like a defining moment, if you know what I mean. I still remember it to this day, and it still brings me to tears, that it was just a defining moment where you say, right, you can earn as much money as you want, or you can be as selfish as you want, but if you can do this to help others, then you're on the way. And that's where it's all come from.
You still feel that's the way to go with your life?
Well, I think even more, because life's become so complicated, and you've got GoFundMe pages where somebody takes a grab out of it and something else goes on and something else goes on. And it doesn't necessarily have to be money. Like, because you're involved in it, we had the situation in Nepal where there was an earthquake, and just the idea came that we try and help these families over in Nepal. And they were going into the monsoon season, and like we basically put the call out that we needed to raise some money to buy these shelter boxes that are supported by the Rotary Clubs. Now, these shelter boxes are $1,000 each, but they can house 10 family members with food and water and shelter for whatever amount of time they need to get back on track and replace their homes and what have you. Now, they're $1,000 each. In 2 days, we raised $22,000, which are 22 basically shelter boxes, but multiplied by that by 10, you've got 220 people that you've never even met that have been housed because of the generosity of the people that trust you and run with you. And what else is there to life, you know what I mean?
So that keeps you going?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's a situation where there's a lot of people out there for the take in this day and age, and I just think that if you can ask somebody for a dollar and then you take that dollar and put it into whatever you're trying to raise the money for and that dollar goes there directly, that's the best way you can do it. And we've got the ability of doing it on the air, as you know.
Well, you didn't get that Academy Award, but you've got a sense of well-being out of these things that you've managed to achieve for other people.
Yeah, and I'm not being idealistic, but I think that if more people looked at what they have inside them and what they can deliver to help others, then that's what it's all about. And, you know, you talk about the Kardashians and they get paid $30 million for a TV series and what have you. I don't think, and I may be wrong here, they're probably very philanthropic, but I think that a lot of the money goes to perpetuate the Kardashians or whoever it may be, and not that much trickles down to those people that really need their help. And I think that's a shame, because if everyone pulled together, it'd be a far better place.
COVID-19 and everything that's happened in the past 12 months, which has been a lot because also where we are, we've had the bushfires and all that kind of thing going on. So we've been exposed to the suffering of a great many people, and now we're looking at it globally. Has the way you see your own future changed and what you want out of life changed because of everything that's been happening in the world?
I think it's been a great emotional correction for a lot of people. I think it determines the kind of person you are, and that to me is interesting, because when you're going through what I call crisis midlife, where you've turned 58, you're looking at where you're going, what you're doing, as you said, is your job going to last or what have you, you just notice some of the quirks of people, and there are really good quirks where people really make you happy and you go, how good was that? and there's really bad quirks where you go, why did you do that? I had a situation only today where I was standing in front of a particular section in the supermarket and this woman came up and deliberately clashed her trolley up against mine and said, do you mind? Can I get in there? And I turned around and said, sure, no problem. I'll get out of your way. But why do that?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Mm. And she just had this look of, I hate everyone and I'm not happy. Now, that's probably because she's scared of what's going on. The amount of people wearing masks in there was more than I've seen before, and she wasn't wearing one, neither was I. But maybe she felt insecure because she thought people were looking at her and she wasn't in a good frame of mind. I don't know. But do we really need that? Because that then escalates into everything else that goes on in the joint. And when I say the joint, I'm talking about the world. And, you know, there's humanity in all of us, and this is a time where we should be showing it, I think.
Well, certainly I don't know that that woman was showing her humanity. She certainly wasn't caring about you or anybody else. She just wanted to move her trolley where she wanted to move her trolley. Are we seeing more of that behaviour, do you think?
Oh, I think people are scared. I really do think people are scared, to be honest. I think that they've got...
So you're saying that that's just bravado?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like the puffer fish, you know what I mean? They puff up and they look like they're going to be the strongest and the ugliest and get out of my way kind of thing. But all she had to do was go, look, excuse me, can I just get in there? Yeah, no problem. How are you? Totally different situation.
Yeah.
You know? And as I said, you can't save the world, but you can save the way people think. And I just think that we need to just pull back, take it easy, and look at helping each other individually, and we're going to be okay. But I had this feeling when I left there, and there were people in the car park giving people the bird. There were some people struggling with masks. There were some people wearing them, some people not. A lot of concerned faces. And I thought, this whole pandemic thing, it's becoming chaotic. And that's the thing. When we first started, it was kind of, okay, let's lock down. This is a bit of a novelty. You and I were saying we'd love to be locked down because that way we can have a rest.
We didn't get it because we had to work through it.
But I think the novelty's gone off, and I think now it's turning into worry, and I think it's turning into chaos.
Mm.
And I think it's a correction because we went, a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, these young kids today haven't been through a war, or they haven't been through this, or they haven't been through a recession and what have you. Well, we're getting the whole thing thrown at us at the moment, and I think it's time to reflect and decide what you want to be. Do you want to be the bitch in this particular supermarket, or do you want to be the good bloke that says, no problem, hope you have a good day?
Mm.
And that's the decision we've got to make, and that's where the correction is.
And that's not really an age thing, is it? You would like to think by the time you hit 50, that midpoint where you're just going, yes, well, there's what am I looking forward to? But you would think you would have a bit more peace in your heart or a bit more kindness to offer others, do you think?
Once again, going back to those disco days, I remember doing discos and you'd test the gear. And some old crotchety old bloke at the local bowling club would say, turn that down. And I'd promise myself that I never would become grumpy, a grumpy old man. It's not so much grumpy, but internally I find more and more as I get older that I'm analysing why people do things to the point where I go, well, do I really want to be like that? Mm-hmm. And that's what you learn along the way, I think.
And that's how you can offer forgiveness to those people as well.
Well, you analyse it and you go, well, you don't know what she's been through. She may have a husband that's sick. She may have, you know, got somebody that's locked down. She could be concerned. But I just don't think that people taking it out on one another for whatever reason is the way to go. And I think it's a time where we need to just take it easy and look out for one another. Where in the past we've kind of gone the old Aussie thing, it'll be right, mate, as long as I'm okay and I've got the mortgage paid and all that kind of stuff. I think it's a case of we need to reach out a little bit more, you know?
And what about for you? What does the future hold for you? You got any dreams?
I've got no idea. No idea at all. Well, I've been in a situation where because your life path has taken you in various and different directions, some good and some bad, that you realise that you can only do what you can do and whichever way that path winds is where you're going to follow. And you trip off the path, you get back on the path, and it's just, that's life, you know. And I think it would be sad if you came through your life and everything went so perfectly, you had so much money in the bank and you never had marriage breakups, and I've had three. If you got to the end of it without looking back and saying, right, I could have learned from that, could have learned from that, it's a pretty boring old life, isn't it?
You've been through quite a bit of trauma in your life as well. So Do you feel all of these things, the marriages, the trauma, do you think it's made you a better person?
It's made me a more forgiving person and understanding more. Like when you go through a marriage breakup, and I've been through three. I pride myself on being married in basically every decade for the last 20 years, or 30 years. And that's circumstance. And it's also the saving situation. I went through a trauma with my mother and father. I wanted to get married and have the perfect marriage. And I got married at 23. By 25, I had three kids because we had twins, three kids under five. And that person saved lives as a nurse. And I went out and made people laugh. And it just didn't work. We're still friends to this day, and I've got three great kids. But at the time, it rips you in half because you haven't learnt the skills of hurt or emotion or breaking up. You know, like it's one of those things, like at 24, it's like the girl at school who says, you're dropped. You don't have the techniques or the tools to deal with it. The second time round, it was a situation where the person's father was dying of cancer when I met them, and I was once again there as the saver and would do everything I possibly could do to make sure that she was okay and that family was okay. But it got to the stage where he passed away and that person pushed everybody and everything out of their life, including me. What do you do with that?
Well, severely traumatic event, isn't it?
And really? We're basically good friends now. And the third one, it was a situation where I had another child, an 8-year-old daughter. And the third situation was, I don't love you anymore. I've decided to travel down the track of moving off with somebody else. So then you've got to try and navigate the life of an 8-year-old as long as you can. And within a month of that happening, my 6-month-old grandson died of a misdiagnosis where we had to switch his life support off. And how do you deal with that? How do you deal with a person you've been married to for 11 years saying it's all over and taking your 8-year-old, and then a month after that you lose your 6-month-old, which you've had no time to spend any life with at all, and you've got to be there for your son? And it's one of those situations where without learning along the way and analysing and getting the tools and putting the tools in place, some people don't survive it. And some, particularly blokes, would sit at the end of the bar and drink themselves to death. Others have got to analyse it and go, right, this is where I've got to be and this is where I've got to go. And others are just numb and would never get over it, and that rolls into their other relationships as they go along the line. But one thing that kept me going is that you're never alone, because you've always got a friend you can talk to. You've always got somebody that will listen. And I used to talk the ears off everybody for months after it, because that was me getting it out and venting or what have you. And you've got to have people around you that are prepared to say, right, I'm prepared to listen. And you will get through it. But there's a lot of people that are in it that unfortunately can't deal with it. And I was in a position where one night it was so dark in regard to my life, I actually sat down and said, I can't do this. I just cannot get through this. I have been through some pretty bad things, but I just cannot get through this. And I would imagine that's the point where people are in a situation where they decide to end it all. And that is a shame. And the proof of that is, as I said, it was so dark I couldn't climb out. And at that particular point, and I call it God whispering, I heard a knock at the front door. This person let themselves in. They'd never been to my house before. They were driving past and basically said, I just had this feeling that you needed to talk to somebody. They came through to the back deck that I was sitting on, and they put their arms around me and I cried and cried and cried. But that was the point that people must get to when they end it. And that's the lowest I could possibly go. And from there, you climb up out of it and keep going. But if there's one message to anyone that gets themselves into that situation, you've got to think, I am not alone in this. And there's too many people these days that are out there that feel that they're alone. And when their life runs into turmoil, they have to deal with it alone. And there's no one to reach out to, and no one knocks on the door, and no one comes down the hallway. And that's when we find people's lives end and people that know them are destroyed. So people come to me all the time and said, how did you get through that? And I simply say, you've just got to keep believing that you're not alone.
Well, I guess that this is why we have those wonderful organisations, Lifeline and Beyond Blue and mm-hmm. Kids Helpline for the younger ones. But that's a pretty amazing story, Graham. Thank you for sharing that.
It happens every day. Mm. You look at the figures and it happens every day, and it's because people just don't have the energy to get through it. And that's where they've got to look at themselves and say, well, I do have the energy to get through this. Nothing could be worse than where I am now, but I've got to climb out of it. And there will be things that happen down the track, but you've got those tools, you've got the experience, you analyse it all. And I suppose that's a good thing about being in your late 50s, that you can look at it in a different way and not make the mistakes that you may have done years before when you hit situations that drag you down.
That's an amazing story, actually. That's really incredible. And hopefully anybody that's listening that's feeling that way will just keep in mind that they're not alone and that there's always someone out there. They're just
And sometimes they've got to trigger it. Like, I was lucky because somebody knocked at the door.
Mm.
And as I said, it was God whispering, because the person had never been to my house before. And it was the exact same moment where I'd been drinking, I'd lost my wife, my daughter had gone with her, lost my grandson. You just get up out of bed the next morning and go, okay, I'm going to go and mow the lawn. It damages you. And sometimes people need to think, that phone's there, I need to talk to a mate, I need to let somebody know I'm feeling this way. And it's only a split second or 2 minutes where you can talk to somebody and they go, okay, I'll come over, or that's all it takes to be okay. But if you don't take that 2 minutes, it literally can be an eternity, not on this planet. And that's what people have got to think of.
Graham, thank you so much for talking today. I really appreciate it, and sharing so much. It's really important. I'm very grateful for it. Thank you.
Thank you.
As I said, the conversation with Graham went in a direction I didn't expect. If you're suffering, talk with someone. You are not alone. There are organisations you can turn to, as I mentioned, Beyond Blue, Lifeline, plenty of great organisations that can help. But why don't you try a bit closer to home first? You might be surprised who's willing to listen. And I tell you what, if they're not willing to listen, they're not much of a friend, or they're not much of a support, so just don't go there again. But you can try. You might be surprised. Just always remember, you matter. Now, I like to finish with a song. This one is by Ross Webb. It is quite moving. Get your box of tissues. But this is only a part of it. You can look him up. You can download the song, all the usual platforms. Ross Webb, Cowgirl Angel. Thanks for listening.
Right on, Cowgirl Angel. You're right. Days and the shine.